January 12, 1962, Lecture 20, Rotation in Space. January 12, 1962, Lecture 20, Rotation in Space.
Your moment of inertia, and that's a very small ratio, and I wasn't even enough to notice on that. So, it will work if you give yourself enough time. I made a summary here of last lecture, but then I've included a table of moments of inertia for you. There's only one thing that I didn't say in the last lecture, which is obvious, that if a thing is made of two pieces around any axis, the moment of inertia of one piece around that axis plus the other piece around that axis together is the total moment of inertia, and that's, of course, because the moment of inertia is a sum. And if I include some of the pieces in one object and the rest in another, it's simply the sum of the two pieces, sort of. And here are a number of moments of inertia of simple idealized things in this column, like a thin rod, which we worked out, all about the center of mass. To get it on any axis, other axis, you use the first relation. And then the disk is 1/2 mr squared if it's perpendicular to the plane. But if you rotate a disk on an axis in the plane, the moment of inertia is less by a factor 2. It's 1/4 mr squared. A solid sphere is 2/5 mr squared. Then from these, it's possible, if you're ingenious enough, using those two principles, to deduce what's over here. That's why I wrote therefore. So all you really have to remember is this. And you can deduce this one and this one and this one from these over here with enough, plus those principles. Anyhow, that's the story of a moment of inertia. Now I want to start today's lecture, which is about rotations in three dimensions, or rotations in space. The things that happen when you take a more realistic situation with lots of particles in mechanics are really quite delightful and surprising. Even though the fundamental law is, after you get used to it, at least a little bit simple, it turns out that with many pieces put together, as in a complicated rotating object, you can get some very surprising consequences. All of the consequences are really consequences of this standard F equals ma, but there's so many things happening at once that it's rather confusing and hard to understand. This happens all the time in physics, and it makes it an entertaining subject, because the fundamental laws are often very simple, and yet the phenomena are delightfully complicated and surprising, and it's all done by mirrors. I mean, it's all done by simple things. But the net result is quite interesting. This is about the first time, save for one other example, where we get a phenomenon which is peculiar. The only other example that I could think of that's analogous is the idea that the moon is falling. That it's falling even though it doesn't get any closer is one of these things. And so you'll find that what happened now is the same kind of funny business. It's falling even though it isn't getting any closer. And so in this lecture, I would like to take one of the most remarkable and amusing consequences of mechanics, and that is to discuss the behavior of a rotating wheel. But the lecture will have two parts. In the first part, I'll tell you what the mathematical formulation is of the motion for rotations in three dimensions, the principles of angular momentum and torque and so on, but applied in three-dimensional space. We will not use these equations in all their generality and find all their consequences, because we're going to be finished with mechanics pretty soon, and of course we can go on forever, but we've decided to stop and to turn to other subjects so that we're only presenting the fundamental laws so you know what they are, applying them to the rotating wheel today, and that's that. So the first part of the lecture is general and describes the laws, the extension of the ideas of rotation in two dimensions to three dimensions and what's involved there. After I'm finished with that mathematical hocus-pocus, I will then turn to the question of the motion of a rotating wheel. So the first thing that comes about is this, that if you have a rotation in three dimensions, an object, say a rigid body or any other system, actually, in three dimensions, then what we deduced for two dimensions is still right. That is, if this is an axis, it is still true that the force in the y direction times the x position of the application of the force minus the y times the x, which is the torque, in the XY plane, the torque that belongs for XY plane, is still this. And this still turns out is still the same as the rate of change of the what we would call, well, of this, if there's a single particle, xpy minus ypx. Because if you'll go back over the derivation of this equation from Newton's laws, you'll see that it has nothing to do with any assumption about the motion being in a plane. It came because when I differentiated this, I got the force, and I certainly will get the force in the y direction. And when I differentiated this, I got the velocity, and the velocity terms canceled out here. So that the theorem is still right. This quantity, then, we call the for a moment, the angular momentum belonging to the xy plane, that is angular momentum associated with the xy motion or xy plane. But since this is true, I can use any other pair of axes, and so I can get another equation. For instance, I use another plane, the yz plane, say, for motion this way, and it is clear from a symmetry that it will go like this, that if, I mean, after all, I just substitute y for z, and x, that it wouldn't be hard to prove the following relationship. No, y, it says here, yeah? Okay, y p sub z minus z p sub y, and that we would, this would be the torque in the yz, and this would be the angular momentum associated with the yz plane. And of course, you could have also another plane, the zx plane, and this would be z f of x minus x f of z is equal to d dt of z p sub x minus x p sub z. And this would be as angular momentum associated with the zx plane. That these three equations, the central ones, can be deduced for motion of a single particle, I don't think you'll doubt. You can check it yourself. They're just the same deductions in one dimension, two dimensions. That if we added many particles such things together and called it the total angular momentum, we would have three kinds, for example, around the three planes. And if we did the sum over here on the forces, we would talk about the total torques associated with the planes x, y, y, z, and z, x. And so we would have the laws that the torque associated with any plane is equal to the angular momentum associated with that plane and so on. And that's clear. I mean, I don't want to go through the derivation, but it's just a generalization of what we wrote in two dimensions. But you say, ah, but there are more planes. After all, what about taking some other axis, some other plane at some cockeyed angle, and calculating the torque on that plane by the forces and so on? So we'd have to write another bunch of equations for more and more and more, and then we'd have a lot of equations. It turns out, it's very interesting, that the if you were to work out the combination x f of y minus y f of x for another plane, but measuring the x and y and the f of x, f of y in that plane, no? That the result that you'd get for the thing that you'd write here can be written as some kind of a combination of these three. It is nothing new. In other words, if you tell me what these three torques about those three planes are, then the torque about on any other plane, and correspondingly also the angular momentum, can be deduced by some combination of these 6% of that and 92% of that and so on. And this problem, this thing, is what I would like to analyze now. It turns out this way. What we need to do, rather, in order to figure that out is the following. We have to discover the law which will tell us this. Suppose that Joe, here we go again, that Joe is calculating these three torques associated with his planes x, y, and z. May I interrupt myself a moment to say that you may get into some trouble with the signs here. Why didn't I call it the zy plane and so on? In all such analyses, it's always a good idea to make yourself a circle and think like this, x, y, z, x, y, z, x, y, z, and so on. X, y is, well, here we haven't got the trouble yet, but we always go x, y, y, z, z, x, x, y, y, z, z, x. That's the cyclic order that we'll write everything out. Now, suppose we have an x, y, z axis that Joe has, and he's worked out all his torques and angular momenta in his plane. But another man has axes in some other direction. And to make it a little easier, I'll just suppose that only the x and y axes have been turned. So his x prime and y prime are new, and his z prime happens to be the same. But he has new planes, let's say, for ZY or for ZX and so on, and he has new torques which he would work out. For example, his torque in the XY plane prime would be equal to his new X, prime the new Y, the force in the new Y direction, and the new Y, and the new force, and so forth. And then he would have also a torque in a YZ direction with new forces, etc. And the thing that's interesting is to find out what the relationship is between the new torques and the old torques, so we'll be able to make a relation from one guy to the other. You say, look, this is just like you did with vectors, and that's just exactly what I'm intending to do. And you might also say, well, isn't this just a vector? And it turns out to be a vector, but we don't know that right away without making an analysis. So on this board, I've made the analysis, although I don't want you to follow every step in detail. I only want to illustrate how it works, maybe at your leisure. If you ever have any leisure, you can figure it out in detail. But I'll go through this much faster than is necessary to make sure that I did all the algebra right. But the idea is the following. Here were the torques calculated by Joe. Mo starts to calculate his torques in a new system. I've already written that relationship and the relationship for his torque in the other plane. Now, between the two axes, I'm going to suppose that one coordinate system is rotated by an angle theta that's fixed. This angle theta has nothing to do with the rotating objects that are in the coordinates or what's going on inside. It's merely the relationship between the axes used by one man and the axes used by another man, and it's supposedly constant. We're just taking the thing on new axes. And you know that the new x is given by x cosine theta plus y sine theta, the new y given this way, and the new z is the same as the old z. Likewise, because force is a vector, it transforms into the new system in the same way as it does with x and y. This was the principle of a vector. A thing is a vector if the various components transform in the same way as x, y, and z. Now we can find out how the torque transforms by merely substituting for x prime the value given here for x prime, for y prime the value for y, f of y prime, I mean, for f of y prime the value for f, and here y, and here f of x. And so we have a rather long string of stuff, and rather surprisingly at first, and then not afterwards, it turns out that it comes right down to x. It all simplifies down to x f of y minus y f of x, which we recognize to be the torque on the xy plane. Well, that's clear. If I only turned my axes in the plane, the twist around on that plane is no different than it was before, because it's the same plane if I only turn my axes in the plane. What's going to be more interesting is when I turn a yz plane around or something like that, because that's a new plane. But the xy plane and the x prime y prime plane are the same. So this was an accident that makes sense. Now the yz part would do exactly the same thing, and all I did is write et cetera. You make all the substitutions, and it comes out as follows, that the result for tau prime yz can be represented in terms of tau yz cosine theta plus tau zx sine theta, and that tau prime zx can be represented as tau zx cosine theta minus tau yz sine theta. As usual, don't pay any attention to the derivation in the sense of memorizing it, but only understand this, and also the result. Understand what the idea of it is. In other words, I wanted to get a rule for finding torques in new axes in terms of torques in old axes, and I have the rule. How can I ever remember that rule? If you look after a few minutes, you see that there's a close relationship between these equations and the equations for x, y, and z. Look, if somehow or other I could call tau x, y, the z component of something, let's call it the z component of tau, then it would be all right. You would understand it like a vector transformation, tau z prime equal tau z, that if I identify with the x, y torque on the x, y plane a z component of an artificial vector, then this z component will be unchanged as it should be. Likewise, if I associate it with the yz plane, the x component of a new and invented vector, and with the zx plane, the y component, then this thing would read tau prime x. I mean, yes, tau in the x prime direction, so to speak, is tau x cosine theta plus tau y sine theta, which is just the rule for vectors. And the other one corresponds to the other one. Therefore, we have proved that if we identify this combination with what we will call the z component of a vector artificially, an artificially invented vector, because the torque is a twist on the plane and it hasn't got any vector character a priori, but mathematically it does have, if we draw a vector at right angles to the plane of the twist, whose length is proportional to the strength of the twist, then the three components of this vector will transform like a vector. In other words, it'll be a real vector. And so we can represent torques by vectors by an artificial trick in which, with each plane on which the torque is supposed to be acting, we associate a line at right angles by a rule. And in fact, we need, to get the sign right, a very peculiar rule. Because if the plane is xy, so that we went x, f of y, and so on, that the torque was this way on the plane, then the axis that we want to associate this with is in the up z direction. So somebody has to define right and left for us. Supposing that the coordinate system is x, y, z in a right-hand system, then the rule will be the following, that if the twist, if you think of the twist as like you were turning a screw thread, and with a right-hand thread like we're used to turning, then the direction of the vector that we'll associate with that twist is in a direction that the screw would advance with a right-hand thread. That's just a question of getting the sign right. So that if there's a torque on the xy plane only, I represent that by a vector up. If the torque is this way, it's a vector down. And we can be, as a result of this derivation, satisfied that we will have a vector, and in a new coordinate system, it'll still be represented by a vector. It's a kind of a miracle of good luck that we can associate with a plane a single axis, and therefore that we can associate with a torque a vector. It's only an accident of three dimensions. In two dimensions, the torque was an ordinary scalar. There was no direction associated with it. In three dimensions, it's a vector. If we had four dimensions, we'd have been in complete and great difficulty. Because, for instance, suppose we had time or something else as a fourth dimension. Then we'd have things like xy, yz, and zx. Then we'd also have xt, and ty, and tz, planes. Yeah? And there'd be six of them. And you can't represent six quantities as one vector, because a vector in four dimensions is only four. So it's an accident that happens to be with three dimensions that we're able to carry all, to remember all these laws of transformation by a tricky gimmick, and that is to associate a vector at right angles to the direction of the torque. Now, then we'll always be in three dimensions for a long time, so we notice that this mathematical proposition didn't depend upon the fact that x was position and f was force. It only depended on the transformation laws. Therefore, if this is instead of x, the x component of some other vector other than displacement, it isn't going to make any difference. In other words, if I were to calculate ax by minus bx ay for a vector, where a and b are vectors, and I calculate this combination, and I call it the z component of some new vector c, some new quantity c, and I do that with like this, then these new quantities form a vector. So we need a mathematical notation for the relationship of the new vector with its three components to the old vectors a and b. And what people have written is that c is equal to a cross b. This is a simple symbol that means this about the components. And we have then the addition to the ordinary theory of vector analysis, we have to add this kind of a new kind of a product. Incidentally, you see that if I reverse A and B, if I call B A and A B, I would have the sign reversed because it would start B X A Y, which is over here. And therefore, this cross product, so-called, this is called the cross product, is unlike an ordinary multiplication, A B equal B A, but in this crazy cross product vector hocus pocus, B cross A is minus A cross B. Also, you can prove right away that if you put B and A equal, this would just cancel out, so that we have another theorem, that A cross A is always zero. In order to make more progress with this cross product, which is so very important for representing the features of rotation, I would like to tell you what the geometrical relationship of these three vectors is. This gives a relationship in components. And from that, you can figure out what the relationship is in geometry. And the answer is this, that the vector C, you can readily prove, is perpendicular to both A and B. Try to calculate C dot A with this definition and see if it doesn't cancel out. C is perpendicular to A and B. If A is a vector in space, and B is a vector in space. Not in a plane like I have to draw it on the blackboard, but please imagine depth here, otherwise you'll not understand the drawing. Then draw a line at right angles to both A and to B. That is the direction of C. And if the magnitude of C turns out to be A, the magnitude of A times the magnitude of B times the cosine between A and B, or if you want, we'll call it theta or something. It's not that theta. It's got nothing to do with it. Forget the. Yes, sine, yeah. Sine theta between the two. It's not this theta in this derivation. In fact, you can forget the derivation if you're willing to believe that this thing is a vector defined this way. That's all I tried to prove here. So this is the definition. And further, one more thing is the sign. Which direction does it point? And the answer is this. If it's A cross B, then imagine that you turn A into B as a screw, and the right-hand thread of the screw will advance in the direction of C. If you've done any work at home with screwdrivers, you can instinctively feel which direction it should move. If you're not used to it, well, you have to invent some kind of rule for yourself to remember, the right-hand rule. I make my fingers go this way, my thumb goes that way, and so on and so on. But anyway, it's this way, you know? The fact that it's a right-hand rule instead of a left-hand rule is a convention and is a perpetual reminder that a vector, that if A and B are ordinary, honest vectors in the ordinary sense, that the new kind of a vector that we've created is a kind of artificiality or slightly different in its character than the others because it was made up with a special rule. A vector, if these are called ordinary vectors, we have a special name for them. We often call them polar vectors, ordinary vectors, like, for instance, the coordinate, the force, the momentum, the velocity. Those are ordinary polar vectors. Vectors which involve one cross electric field, one cross product in it somewhere in this definition, are called axial vectors by some people, and the more then also called pseudo vector. And examples of pseudo-vectors are, of course, the torque, which is what the whole thing is about. Another pseudo-vector is the angular momentum, because this relation torque equals angular momentum derivative, which I'm going to write here, is just obvious that the angular momentum is made of something like that. So the angular momentum is another one. We'll soon, well, I'll tell you without proving it, that the angular velocity is also a pseudo-vector, that torques, forces, angular velocities. Oh, a funny one that's a pseudo vector is a magnetic field. Now, those are examples of these things. In order to complete our mathematics, we should know all the rules for the multiplications of cross products. We here at this lecture and for our applications at the moment will need very little of it, but for the sake of completeness, I'm going to write down all of the rules of vector multiplication so that you can figure out anything someday. Just to complete, so to say, your knowledge. If you have the sum of two vectors cross a third one, then like a product, it's A cross C plus B cross C. Or if you have a multiple of a vector cross another one, oh, not that, cross another one, then it's the same as the multiple of the cross. If now, the combinations of crosses and dots are interesting. If you have A dot, B cross C, there should be vector marks on these. This turns out to equal A cross B dot C. That's called the rule of interchanging the dot and the cross. Finally, there's one other product that you could have three vectors. You could have A, B cross C, which is a vector, and then cross it again with A, which is called a double cross product, whatever you want. And you can get more and more complicated, but there's an interesting rule that reduces that back into ordinary things, which I like to call the back cab rule. It's the only way I can remember it. And I write it like this. The vector B times A dot C minus the vector C times A dot B. And I imagine it in capital letters, back, cab, and the capital is the vector, and the other two are in the dot product. Why back cab means anything, I don't know. But anyway, that's the rule, and those are the rules of vector multiplication. But the most important, one of the most important properties is not on the list, but I wrote it earlier on the other thing, and that is that A cross A is 0, and that A dot A cross B is also 0. These are two propositions which tell us that a vector cross itself is 0, and that a vector, the cross product is perpendicular to either one of the inside parts. Those are all the rules of vector analysis of cross products. Now, I want to talk about the equations that we would now have in physics using this cross product. And I guess the best place to begin is right here where I have the equation. After all this effort, we see that the first half of these equations, with the identification about the axes, can be written this way, that the torque is equal to the position vector cross the force. That's a vector summary of the three equations, this part. This is equal in this thing to the rate of change, well, of the angular momentum. But you see by the same token that the angular momentum vector is the radius of a particular, if there's only one particle present, is the distance of the particle, the vector from the origin, multiplied by the vector momentum. So there's the torque and the angular momentum. That's this is equal to L, and this is equal to that. But this is kinematics, it's definitions, rather. It's the definition of the torque and the angular momentum. But the dynamical law, the law of Newton, F equals ma, for three-dimensional space rotations, has as a consequence this great law, which you see here. And that's it. Now, the torque is the rate of change with time of the angular momentum in three dimensions. Another consequence of this is this. Well, I wrote it only for a single particle. You can do the sums over many particles, and it turns out then that the external torque on a system is the rate of change of the total angular momentum. We'll let you prove that. The total torque on a system is the rate of change of the total angular momentum. And also, another theorem. If the total torque is 0, if the external torque is 0, then the angular momentum total is a constant. And this is called the law of conservation of angular momentum. If there is no torque on something, the angular momentum can't change. So I wanted to demonstrate that thing in a moment, but we have to get the self-propagating machine out here again in order to show how that works. Self-propelling machine. You guys are self-propagating machines. While I'm doing that, though, I would like to talk about the angular velocity vector. If you take an object, a solid body, now we talk about a rigid body, because otherwise there's no definition of the angular velocity in a moving with a lot of different parts moving inside. But for a rigid body, we talked about turning it about an axis. But we, for instance, for a moment, suppose that we're turning it simultaneously about two axes, if you wish. It's in a box which is turning this way, and the box is turning that way. It turns out that that's the same. If you're turning it this way and this way at the same time, if in a moment, let's say in infinitesimal time, you go this way and that way, the net result is to turn it, if you figure it out, about some new axis. And the wonderful thing about this new axis is that it can be figured out this way. If omega 1 x is drawn as a, if the rate of turning in the xy plane is written as a vector in the z direction, whose length is equal to the rate of rotation in the xy plane, and if a vector is drawn in the y direction, say, which is the rate of rotation on the zx plane, and also for the third, if you want a more complicated case, then if you'll add these together as like a vector and draw the resultant, the magnitude of this tells you how fast it's turning, and the direction tells you what plane, by the rule of perpendicular. It's rotating in the perpendicular plane at a speed given by the superposition. That is to say, simply, angular velocity is a vector where you draw the velocities of rotations in the three planes as projections at right angles to those planes. Under those circumstances, then, we have, well, that's the definition, that's the way angular velocity works. As a special equation, for instance, that you can show is that the power, which is, of course, the rate of change of work with time. You see, remember, the work on the one dimension was T delta theta in one dimension. The power would be T delta theta dt for a rigid body. So this would be tau omega for a rigid body. But the power in three dimensions turns out to be tau dot omega. In fact, it's possible to prove that omega is a vector by a method by arguing that the power is a scalar. And you've just proved that tau is a vector. So you have to prove, they can conclude that omega is a vector. But never mind. We'll just suppose we know that. All our formulas that we wrote in a plane can be generalized. For example, if we have a rigid body, all this is for rigid bodies here. If we have a rigid body, and we're turning it about a certain axis, omega, you might ask, what is the velocity acquired by an object at a certain radial distance r? And I just leave it as a problem for you to fool around with to show that the velocity of a particle in a rigid body is given by omega cross r, when omega is the angular velocity and r is the position. Also, as another example of cross products, we had a formula for Coriolis force. And the formula for the Coriolis force can also be written in cross products. I'm just giving you examples of cross products. The force of Coriolis turns out to be 2m. I better get the sign right now. Just let me look. V cross omega. If a particle is moving with velocity v in a coordinate system which is in fact rotating at angular velocity omega, but you want to disregard that and think in terms of that coordinate system, then you'll have to add the pseudo force of the Coriolis force. And those are some examples of cross product. But I guess you got that propagating machine ready, and you find out that it's nothing but a wheel. That's all it is, a rotating wheel. It's all I had in the box. And the way that it works is the following. If I take this wheel and sit on the chair, then the wheel has an angular momentum, but it's around the horizontal axis. The angular momentum around the vertical axis can't change because there's a frictionless pivot, vertical. So if I were to try to turn the thing this way, then it will have angular momentum about the vertical axis because it's spinning around this axis and its angular momentum is in that direction. When I turn it up, the angular momentum is this way. It has a component vertical. But it can't have any, the world can't, my world can't have any component vertical. So I have to turn around to balance it. I got my signs wrong, apparently. Presumably, whichever way this is spinning, it must be spinning this way. So the angular momentum is that way. Then when I turn it, it has a component down, I have to have a component up. And so the conservation of angular momentum maintains me going around to balance the fact that this wheel is going around. And when I turn it back this way, when I turn it this way, the sign is, of course, reversed. With regard to this nonsense of taking off the fins were this down at the bottom. If I take the fins off and put them on the top and then turn the box over, obviously it doesn't make any difference because nothing about this has anything to do with it. It's only the relation of the vertical to the direction. Now, the fact that I was able to hold the box up, let's try that one now, is another thing that we'll have to discuss. Yeah. The fact that the box will stay up on the ends of my fingers is something we'll have to study in a minute. To demonstrate that most nicely, let's put it up here. It shows that it has nothing to do with humankind. It's simply a property of a rotating wheel. And so I put the wheel on the edge of this thing and let it go. And you see it holds itself up in some manner or other as it goes around. But the essential part of it is that it's going around. That's the vital thing. If it weren't going around, it wouldn't stay up. And when I was holding it up, I tried to confound you on that subject. I was turning all the time, so it was going around, although I was walking about with it. That had nothing to do with it. The fact that I was turning is what kept it up. And we'll have to understand next why a wheel which is going, if you don't mind, I know you're nervous about dropping this, but it's so delightful that I'd like to let it go around. Oh, it's going the other way this time. Must have been turned over somehow. If it gets low, take it off. The question is, what is balancing the obvious torque which exists due to gravitation? And I'd like to explain how the thing works, first completely mathematically, and then more physically. I guess I'm getting nervous myself. You can start the other wheel. First, I explain the thing in terms of the mathematics that we've just invented. Here is the wheel in a box. The wheel is here. And it's spinning around an axis. I'll never get the signs right, but I'll do my best. It's spinning about an axis. Therefore, its angular velocity is about this axis, and it turns out its angular momentum is likewise all of this type. In other words, the angular momentum vector, if this is the plane of rotation, the angular momentum vector is represented by a vector along here, and it's spinning very fast, and we'll call that L0. Now, suppose that the box, we wish to rotate the box about the vertical axis at a small angular velocity. What forces are required? Let me look down on the box. Let's look down on it from a vertical axis. So down we're looking. After a short time, the box is turned to a new position. In other words, after a short time, delta t, the new axis is in this direction. And since the major part of the angular momentum is the spin on the axis, and there's very little contributed by the slow turning, disregarding that little bit, the great majority of it is still along this new direction. And if in a time delta t, this thing is turned through an angle delta theta, then you see that the angular momentum vector has changed. This is the change in angular momentum. The same as that dumb circle business. Although the angular momentum doesn't change in size, it changes in direction. And as long as it changes in direction, there has to be there's a change in angular momentum here. This change is in magnitude L0 delta theta. Delta theta is the time, this is the change in angular momentum in the time delta t. The torque is the rate of change of the angular momentum with t, or in our case for the approximation, delta L over delta t, which is, of course, L0 times delta theta over delta t. In other words, it's L0 times the angular velocity of precession. That's got nothing to do with the angular velocity of spin. That's another proposition. That's around the axis. But then there's the angular, the slow angular velocity of precession is this, and then this is the torque. And the proposition, never mind the directions, the proposition is the following. If we have a wheel which has a high angular momentum, L naught, let's say horizontal, and we turn it with a slow angular velocity, omega precession about that, then we must exert a torque given by L0 omega precession. And to get the signs right, you can remember the whole formula. If you work it out in more, I can't remember it, but I got the signs right once. I hope it's right. That the general formula is that the torque is omega precession cross the angular momentum, L0, around the axis. So that's why the gyroscope stands up. That's no explanation at all. What one gets a feeling here, that you've got a mathematical explanation by the law ddt of L and so on, that's perfectly satisfactory. And that somehow or other, the mathematics is faster thinking than you are. Because it gives the right, what about this torque? This is, of course, the torque which is balanced by gravity. The gravity exerts this torque, and it balances. And this tells you how fast it has to precess if you could figure out how much the torque of gravity was and how much the angular momentum around the axis is. I say about this that, let me just demonstrate something on this one, that the force that the motion, well, when I apply a force, or a torque, rather, the precession is at right angles to the direction of the torque always. If, for instance, I apply a force this way, then I'm making a torque that way around here, and if I try to push it that way, it'll move the other way. You see, it doesn't go the way I want. If I push it that way, it goes that way. And if I try to push it this way, along here, it'll fool me and go the other way. It always goes at right angles. It's not obstinate. It's only kind of compromises. The hell with it. I'll go at right angles. It doesn't go against you. It just doesn't give. That's all. By going instead at right angles. And that's the way this thing worked. In addition, with this particular device, we'll show something else. This thing has been built so there are pivots everywhere so that you can turn all the axes around and do all kinds of things. But notice that while this thing goes around, all the pivots are turning and so on in such a way as to leave to a good approximation, the approximation only because there's some friction, this axis unchanged. Why? Because if there were no torques, the angular momentum must stay constant, not only in size but in direction. And so the conservation of angular momentum maintains that axis. So we could, if we wanted to navigate in the world, build such a gadget, and it'll keep pointing north if we set it north, or up, or whatever. Now, in order to understand this thing better, however, this is a mathematical thing, and that appears as a miracle. And it'll turn out, as we go in more and more advanced physics, that many simple things can be deduced mathematically more rapidly than they can be really understood in a dynamic sense or a simple sense. And this is a funny characteristic. And it turns out that as you get into more and more advanced work, there are circumstances in which the mathematics will produce results which nobody has really been able to understand in any direct fashion. An example, for example, is that some of the consequences of the Dirac equation, which come in a very beautiful mathematical way, but it's hard to understand. And in this particular sense, it looks like some kind of a miracle of right-angled circles and twists and right-hand screws by which it goes. But what we need to do is to understand it in a more physical way. And I will try to explain to you what the torque is due to when a thing is precessing. Suppose that we imagine, I mean, I have to find the torque in terms of the real forces and the accelerations. I would like to show you that when you have a rotating wheel that's spinning very fast around this axis, and the whole thing is turning this way slowly, that there's necessarily a set of forces like this. And we'll see why. Because suppose that it were turning this way. Then it's much like a diagram that I drew for you before. The particles that are going around the top of the wheel for a moment are not really moving in a straight line because the wheel is turning. And as we explained at last time, because earlier, a moment earlier when the particle, say, is here, the wheel is in this position. And then when the particle's in the middle, the wheel is in that position. And then when the particle is it, when the wheel is turned, the particle's in that position. Well, no, anyway. Of course, all on top of each other. I didn't want to draw them all on top of each other. You see, well, it's probably better to do that. There's the particle going up, and then it comes further up, and it's over here. You see that the particle goes in a curve. And in order to make a particle go in a curve, there must be a force exerted on it sideways. So because as this thing turns, the particles are moving in a curve, there must be somebody must be pushing this way, namely this rigidity of the wheel through the spokes. Must be turning this way, and so I have to do that. Wait, you say, what about the stuff that's going down on the other side? At the bottom of the wheel, this is at the bottom. I don't know how to draw it, but at the bottom of the wheel, underneath, the material is going back, and the wheel is still turning the same way. Therefore, it starts in this position, yes. Therefore, they're going like this, down on the floor, underneath. And therefore, there must be a force this way on the bottom. So the net force that I have to apply in this direction is zero. The forces balance out. But one of them must be applied at the top of the wheel, and the other must be applied at the bottom of the wheel. And I could do that directly, but because the wheel is solid, I'm allowed to do that by turning the axle because of forces are carried up through the spokes, you see. So that when I turn the axle this way, I am applying to the rim of the wheel the force this way at the top and that way at the bottom, and that's why when a wheel is precessing, a torque must be exerted to balance it. All that I've said, therefore, is that if the wheel is precessing, it can balance the gravity. In other words, I showed you that that's a solution of the equation. That is, that if the torque is given as the gravitation, and if you've got it started right and is precessing, if you start it right, then this thing will balance out. It's much like the force of centrifugal force balancing a thing going in a circle. Suppose you say the force is stronger. Of course, then it comes in. And if it turns out the torque is too big to match the precession rate, then something happens. It starts to wiggle and it picks up a new precession rate. In fact, I would like to demonstrate a few points on this to understand it better. Here is a gyroscope. I hope it's going fast enough. If it isn't, we'll see. Yes, it's going fine. It's precessing fine. And it balances the torque due to its own weight. But the moment it hits that, it can no longer precess. This torque, this inertial torque business here, it goes to zero because I'm not allowing it to precess. And there's absolutely nothing left of the gyroscopic effect, and it simply falls. To illustrate that even more clearly, you see there's a very peculiar thing that behaves a lot, much like a gyroscope. If I push it, it goes up. If I push it various ways, it's a complete gyroscope. But if I were to confine the gyroscope and hold it fixed, and so that when you're inventing gyro stabilizers, remember that you can't tie the gyroscope down and have it do anything, because if I tie it down as I do in this frame, it doesn't work at all. It just is an ordinary thing. It doesn't have anything to do with the fact that it's rotating. It's only because it's allowed to do this that it's able to exert a torque to balance the gravity. So it's essential that the thing be turning. So the theory of the gyroscopes is really very simple in this respect. I mean, the theoretical formulas for doing problems is very simple. After you get the directions right, all you need to know is that the torque that's exerted from the outside must be equal to L0 times omega precession, and that'll tell you what rate it will precess. But people like to say things about a gyroscope which makes it very hard to understand really how it works. You may not want to pay attention to this understanding really how it works, and what I'm going to say might be confusing, but it's closer to the complete truth. If you would like to worry only about problems, then stop listening for a while and just remember that formula. But if you want to understand a little bit more how a gyroscope works, you have to watch out that you don't say some things. Lots of people like to say that when you exert a torque on a gyroscope, it turns, it precesses, that the torque produces the precession. And that is very strange, that when you let go of the gyroscope, because there's gravity acting, it moves that way. The big problem is, really, how is it that the downforce, which you know and you feel the downforce of the gravity, makes it go that way? And all the formulas in the world aren't like this, aren't going to tell us, because this is a balanced equation after it's nicely precessing. But I would like to show you the following, that really what happens is in detail the following. If I were to hold the thing absolutely fixed so it can't precess in any manner, but it's spinning, then there's no torques from the gyro anything. And there's not even a torque from gravity because it's balanced by my fingers. But if instantaneously I let go of it, boom, then there'll be a torque started from gravity all of a sudden. And anybody in his right mind would think that the thing would fall, and that it does, as you will see. As I let go, you'll see that it will go down. This white spot will move up the instant I let go. Well, it didn't work very. I have to let go very sharply. It's going too fast. If I take less speed, it'll be more obvious. Wait. Let it slow down a little bit, and I'll show you better. I'll tell you what's going to happen, and we'll see what the idea is. What really happens is that the gyro actually does fall. Think of the wheel spinning this way here, and there's a weight on it. Then it does start to fall. It's honest. I mean, it's an honest thing. It really falls, like you'd expect. But as soon as it falls, it's turning, right? It begins to turn. And the moment a gyroscope turns, then there's a torque generated. So the moment it starts to go down, there's a turning like this, and there's a torque. But which way is the force? If you think about it, because of the turning, the force is that way, which is all wrong. It doesn't balance in the gravity at all. That's right. Force is that way, and the response of the gyroscope to the force in the finest detail is that it merely moves as a result, just like the gravity pulled it down, this other force turns it this way. But it starts to turn this way. And when it's turning this way, there's a force that goes lifting now. And the force that goes lifting builds up and exceeds, in fact, the gravity, and it lifts itself up again. But it falls again, like this. But when the thing is spinning fast, you can't see this. It's too quick for the eye. And so you'll just talk about the average as just a drift. But in fact, it does it by falling. Now, I hope that the wheel is going slower enough that it'll be more obvious. The slower it is, the more obvious, because if I let go, I hope it goes up. It's still weak. Let me get still slower, so it's more obvious. Huh? You could see it that time? See, if I let go, it goes like that. See? And get this out of here in time. You'll notice that after a while, it isn't doing it anymore. And the reason is a friction in the bearings, up and down bearings and so on. That's a very rapid motion, and it's easily damped out. Especially when it's fast, it goes beep, 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 and settles down. And when it settles down, listen, it's a little bit lower than it was before. And let me show you why that is. This is all the details, the more complicated details. But I explain it because I don't want you to get the idea that gyroscope is an absolute miracle. It's a wonderful thing, but it's not an absolute miracle. If I were holding this thing absolutely horizontally and would suddenly let go, then the simple equation would tell me that it precesses. That's the answer. It goes around in a horizontal plane. But that's impossible. Because if it's going around, although I did neglected it before, it is true that the whole darn thing has some moment of inertia about this axis. And if it's going around about that axis, even slowly, it's got a weak angular momentum about that axis. And where did that come from? If there was a perfect pivot here, there's no torque. And how the hell does it get to precess if there's no angle, there's no, should be any angular momentum change? And the answer is this, that the net result of this beep, 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 beep business is to settle down halfway down. You know, I mean, it overshoots, and so it goes like this. Where this is the envelope, you see? So it's settled down a little bit low. And by being a little bit low, some component of its spin angular momentum is now down. And this component of the spin angular momentum is exactly matched by the angular momentum of the precession. So you see, it has to go down in order to go around. It has to give a little bit of the gravity. So at last, it isn't so completely impossible. What happens when you let go of the thing is it falls, it does this, and then goes around and finds its balance. And then the angular momentum, it's going around the same way as I did on that table. By turning its axis down a little bit, it maintains a rotation about the vertical axis. That then is the way a gyroscope works. And that is as far as we're going to go formally in our equations, in which we'll have problems and so on in the mechanics. But I cannot leave the subject of rotations in three dimensions in this condition without telling you at least qualitatively of a few effects that you can expect, not in the form of equations, but just to understand the phenomena roughly that occur in the three-dimensional rotations, which is not self-evident at first. And the main effect that is important to recognize, although we won't have any much study directly in our own situation, is the following. This is the most important, that with a rigid body, in general, most general case, the angular momentum is not necessarily in the same direction as the angular velocity. Look, consider a rod that's hung onto a shaft, that's tied onto a shaft in a lopsided fashion like that, through the center of gravity, to be sure. When I spin that rod around this axis, anybody in his right line knows there'll be some kind of shaking at the pivots because of the funny way I've got it unbound. In fact, if you want to know why, it's because there's centrifugal force. People don't like me to think that. If in a rotating system, there's centrifugal force this way, so there's a torque exerted on here. And if there's a torque on the pivots, there must be a rate of change of angular momentum. And how can there be a rate of change of angular momentum if, when I'm turning it about this axis, the angular momentum is about that axis? It ain't. And I'll try to analyze it for you. I know it's after the bell, but just give me half a minute, and I'll show you what happened. Let's suppose this is a rod, for instance. Then I can analyze the velocity part way this way and part of the angular velocity this way, where it's projected down and they go right along that axis. But how about the angular momentum? The rod's angular moment of inertia about this axis is different than the moment of inertia about that. In other words, for this to turn a rod this way, around this way, is a lot more a moment of inertia than to turn it this way, which is because all the mass is near the axis. So the moment, the angular momentum, is, which is on a particular special axis only, is the moment of inertia times the angular velocity, will have a large angular momentum here in this direction. And in spite of this velocity, because the moment of inertia is low, the angular momentum along this is small. And therefore, the angular momentum vector is in a direction in space, not along the axis. And it's because when I turn the object that I have to turn that angular momentum vector in space that I must exert torques on the shaft. Now, we're not going to analyze it quantitatively, but I did want to explain some of the principles that don't work so easy that you might have thought otherwise. Angular momentum need not be in the direction of the angular velocity.
Yeah.
Is the B crossed with A dot C?
No, it's a vector B multiplied by a scalar. Ordinarily, you'd probably prefer to write A dot C B because you like to put the scalar in front of the vector. But I can't remember the formula that way. So I remember it the other way around.
It's a vector. It's a zero vector.
Yeah, which? What?
Well, that's a zero vector.
This? Vector, yeah. That's right. And the other one is not a zero vector.
A dot A
cross B. It's a scalar. That's correct.
If you change the rotation, will it start bouncing up and down?
If I did what? The speed? Yes. If it would do the same bouncing up and down, but you'll have to be very careful to notice it because it does it so much more rapidly. As it's going fast, you see it's more rapid. And the higher speed, the more rapid is that.
If it is progressive, and then
it doesn't have to wobble then, yeah.
And then you change the
speed of progression?
Yeah.
Suppose we try. We increase it, it goes down. We decrease it, it goes up. Actually, the other way, because the wheel's on the other side. It should be this way, that if I stop it, it falls, which it does, although it looks like it's going up because it's on the other side. And if I help it along, it lifts. If I help it do what it wants to do, it lifts. In other words, if a thing is precessing a certain way, like a top or something, and you want it to come up higher, then push it this way it's going. And if you want it to give up and fall, then you stop it from turning in the direction that it's going. So what happens is that the thing gets balanced. That's what I tried to explain after a while. And although initially it's quite complicated, and that usually they forget all the details, and then it's hard to understand because you've only got the net balance. It's something like the moon going around the sun that doesn't fall. I'm going around the earth and doesn't fall. If the speed were wrong, it would fall. It would come in too fast, pick up angular momentum, and go too fast. It goes in an ellipse, which is like a radius doing this. And it's the same thing. It wobbles around the nice solution if it's going the wrong speed. Is it going too fast for you?
Your frictional losses would only be subtracted from infinity, and, you know, it would be...
Incidentally, the complicated motion, if you're interested in that, this motion here is really a compound of two things. You can say, well, it's precessing, and at the same time, it's going around a certain center. This is the same kind of motion as a point on a wheel would make if the wheel were to rotate and roll. If you put a point on it, it's a cycloid. If you put it on a wheel, it would go like this. So it's a combination of two. It's a rotation about a certain center. and the drift of the center. Now, what is the center about which it rotates? Very amusing. This thing is like my off-center shaft. It's really what happens is it finds out the angular velocity gets off-center of the main axis, and so the thing goes around that. So it's really a rotation around a slightly different axis, plus a drift. So this speed is almost as fast as the speed of rotation, you see. Here?
No, the negative
value. Here?
Yeah, you got your answer, B times AC, not that.
This is a scalar product.
Now, the B times that.
And that just means you multiply a number times the vector B. Ordinarily, you would... This is a number, so you ordinarily write it this way, perhaps. But I can't remember the formula that way, so I remember it backward. There's just a scalar number multiplying the vector B, and another scalar number multiplying the scalar C, the vector C. You want to slow it down?
It's all right.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that'll help.
It's almost going to stop at that speed. Okay. You got.
It's got a lot of losses in it.
Yeah, there are losses.
That air floated one will work beautifully on that.
Well, you're going to have it in the lab for them to play with?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
good.
It'll be in the lab.
Well, then they'll understand it much better because it's hard
to. The mutation doesn't damp out at all.
It doesn't?
I demonstrated it for the Frosch lab.
No.
I forgot to call it notation. Yeah, this wobble is called notation.
And it really works.
But it damps out.
Yeah.
But what happens is you can't, when it's running fast, you can't see it with the eye. So it's very hard to understand the gyro then, because all it does is go around when it should fall.
Right.
And of course it does fall, but it takes a little. I made a problem up.
Okay.
But very difficult one. Excuse me. And left it home, apparently. I left it home.
That's right.
It's two problems. One was to carry out this transformation with the tau.
Yeah, good idea.
And the other problem, I can outline to you if you want. Sure. The problem goes, if you can remember it, it has to do with, I don't know whether you want to bother them with this notational aspect or not, but if for the advanced student who want to worry about it more than the other, the following is interesting.
Yeah.
First, after it has gotten precessing, it started a wheel, the rule of problem is a wheel with angular momentum L0 about a major certain axis of spin is held rigidly horizontally. Mm-hmm. At one end is suddenly released. And then it ends up ultimately with the nutation damped out precessing.
Yeah.
What angular velocity does it precess if tau is the torque of your gravitation around the support axis? Answer, L omega precession is equal to tau. Now go further. That's in the first correction, assuming that it fell slightly, how far is it below the original axis? That's the next problem. And if you're supposing that the moment of inertia for rotation about this axis is called IA, then the answer is that IA omega precession must equal L0 epsilon, and that gives epsilon the angle of 4, all right, which we suppose small. That's the second part of the problem. Now, the third part of the problem is to calculate the work done by gravity, how much work gravity has done in the fall from one position to the other. This is an energy problem. Okay? And it's clear, it's the torque times the angle through which the torque is gone. So this is the work. And if you substitute this formula for the angle in here, or for the torque, rather, you get L0 omega precession times epsilon, right? And L0 epsilon is IA omega. So you find IA omega precession squared.
Yes, right, sure.
Now you say, how much angular kinetic energy will it have due to the precession?
Half of that.
And the answer is that that kinetic energy is one half of IA. It still has. And the question is, what happened to the extra work? And the answer is, that was the energy of the nutation, which is damped up. Isn't that, that's nice. It may be too advanced, but you know, might want to talk about notation, but that's...
Well, it's essentially a simple harmonic oscillator, which is...
Yeah, but it's a problem which is...
That energy goes away.
Yeah, I don't know if you wanted or not, but that was it.
Well, there's some features there. I'll try another one.
All right, see if you can make up one piece of it or something.
This is another one of the example of what I was saying.
You mean doing it right and wrong?
Well, why we had you do the whole thing.
Yeah.
God, that was
because it took me, you know, to really understand.